Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today we're excited to have Chris Natterney. Chris is a nationally recognized C-level recruiter and has spent 30 years with Spencer Stuart, which is a leading global executive search firm. His executive search clients include leading Fortune 500 companies, private equity portfolio companies, and later stage startups. Along the way, he counseled and helped guide the careers of several thousand executives, ranging from CEOs to vice presidents across multiple functions and industries. Since retiring from Spencer Stuart, Chris developed a career management consultancy focused on helping executives reap desired careers. His recent career guidebook, The Proactive Executive, a C-suite recruiter's five-step system for achieving greater career success, encapsulates insights from his interactions with thousands of successful executives throughout his career. You can find Chris on Twitter at @NatterneyChris, and that's N-A-D-H-E-R-N-Y, and his website is chrisnatterney.com. So welcome, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Sue. I've been looking forward to it.
And where are you calling from today?
I am calling from Florida.
Ah, okay, great.
And it's 84 degrees, sunny, with a out of a light breeze.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, Chris, as I often start, this is our 15th year, and I've done a lot of these, and I always start with the same question. I want to know a little bit more about your journey. I've said the bio, but I am really interested to know why you decided to write the book, The Proactive Executive. So you can tell us a little bit about that to start.
Thank sure. Sure, Sue. Well, first, congratulations on 15 years.
Thanks.
That's a real accomplishment. During the years that I was with Spencer Stuart, obviously met a lot of very bright, capable, driven executives, and not all of them were successful. And what always was of keen interest to me was what differentiated the more successful careers from those who were less successful. And so with, you know, a number of observations across these countless assessments, executive assessments, and conversations, I began to take a look at what was in the market with respect to the formation of successful careers and how to go about it. And there didn't seem to be really anything in the market. The market today, the book market, you can find out how to write a resume, you can find out how to interview, but in terms of managing the longevity of your career effectively so that you optimize the time and the energy and the expense that you put into it, there was nothing out there that I was able to find. So that was the initial incentive for writing the book, to help people with their careers, and within that I include my two sons who are at the early points of their careers.
So what's interesting about your book, though, is it's different from the many, as you said, many books out there, because it's more for executives and how for people that are on the director level. What is it going to take for them to become executives? And so one of the things you talk about is this idea of proactive mindset. Could you talk a little about what that is and how you can cultivate it? And then I'm going to sort of guide us down this path and focus on gravitas and influence, because that is the theme that we're addressing this year. So let's first talk about that proactive mindset.
Sure. What was striking to me over the years was the number of executives who are not appropriately proactive about their careers. And you really need to realize that it's your career. No one's ever going to care more about it than you do. And it's the decisions that you make throughout your career. It's the actions that you take or avoid. It's your level of self-awareness, not only of others, but of your own assets and liabilities. It's your receptiveness to feedback, and your ability to establish a really powerful, differentiated personal brand that make all the difference. And in order to do that, it requires being proactive. Mm-hmm. So essentially, you know, you're the CEO of your career. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to take control of it.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the importance of influence. I was talking to a client the other day in learning development, and we were talking about, like, what's the difference between a director and a VP in terms of their skills. And I said to her, well, I think influence is, you know, probably one of the biggest things that we deal with. And so I'd like to get your opinion about that. Like, how do you see the idea of influence becoming more and more important as you go up the ladder?
Oh, it's absolutely critical, Sue. You know, the more senior your role in an organization, the more you have to rely on and work through others to get things done. So, you know, your success, you know, regardless of how smart or confident you are, is increasingly dependent on the cooperation of others. So the influencing, the collaboration, the leadership skills become paramount.
Could you give us some examples of what you see where people might falter and then where they actually and then get derailed and then also obviously where they do well?
Sure. Some of the areas where I see people get derailed is that they do not have an appropriate level of ability in terms of forging productive interpersonal relationships, both within and outside the company. And that takes some deliberate effort. It takes some thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that has a lot to do with being able to team with others, whether it's cross-functionally or within your own group. Because as you go up higher in terms of responsibility in an organization, you have to shape the thinking and actions of your colleagues. You know, you have to build and lead and motivate groups, and you also need to have influence in navigating the complexities of the organization. So I have seen some very bright, very capable executives who, as long as they're focused on the technical aspects of the job, they succeed. But as soon as they're thrown into a managerial capacity, they either have to learn very quickly or they just, you know, they get lost.
So I think that everyone I work with, and I'm sure probably most of the people you work with, know that networking is important when it comes to careers and also just getting their pitches done, you know, getting what they want, whether it's budget or resources or whatever. I mean, these relationships are really important, networking both inside the company and outside. So everyone knows this. I mean, I don't think if you talk to everyone, everyone would say, yes, it's important, but they don't do it. You know, it's just, what do you think is stopping people? Is it just time or what do you think it is?
Yeah, I think it requires a very conscientious effort to observe dynamics within the organization. I think very fundamental to this is someone's awareness. And when I mention awareness, I'm talking about, you know, multiple kinds of awareness. You know, there's self-awareness, there's situational awareness, there's feedback awareness, reputation awareness, organizational awareness. But regardless of any of those, it needs to be an observed, you know, you have to be making observations. You have to be mindful in, you know, in being in the moment. And whether you're reading the room, developing a broader understanding of what the organization's objectives are and where your efforts fit in, you know, to the mission, the strategy, and the plans. That's the sort of backdrop that makes it easier to develop influence.
Sure. So you mentioned the awarenesses, and that was one of my questions. You described the different types of awarenesses being central to a person's career, and you describe them in your book. Can we go through them? I'd like to go through each of them and get some examples of those, and then and we'll call for some questions.
Sure. Well, let me briefly describe them.
Okay.
Self-awareness is I would define it as conscious knowledge of your own character, strengths, weaknesses, your feelings, your motives, your desires, and how you react under different situations, whether stressful situations, this self-awareness is absolutely critical if you're going to have influence, whether it's one-on-one or within a group or in leading an organization. Situational awareness, by that I mean a manager's ability to observe what's going on around him or her, whether it's within the company, the marketplace, an industry, the economy, and then properly frame what's occurring and why they believe it's occurring, assess the business threats and opportunities, and then take an appropriate course of action and how to best carry out that action. And situational awareness is something that typically develops with experience. Different experiences, working in different parts of the economic cycle, working in a turnaround versus a growth scenario. So that's situational awareness. Feedback awareness, I have clearly seen that those executives who openly seek formal and informal feedback throughout the course of their careers, they achieve more rapid personal growth. And this, you have formal feedback, which consists of the annual or periodic performance reviews, as well as direct input from mentors and coaches. But you also have informal feedback, which a lot of people don't look for as actively. So, these are the signals that you receive from others, throughout the course of your daily activities, whether it's in meetings, presentations, customer interface, teleconferences. I've met, some executives who just either they're closed to receiving this feedback, or they become so focused on their own agenda that they don't even realize that there's feedback being provided them. Listening awareness is aligned to a number of these, and I'm sure we've all been in a situation or the room where somebody dominates the conversation and is not listening. And the higher you go in an organization, in order to understand what's going on across the organization, you have to be willing to listen. And so, great listening skills are not only critical, for receiving and acting on feedback, but they also have a profound role in your ability to lead, manage, and influence others. If you're an active listener, others are going to want to engage and team with you, and you'll find that your accomplishments are going to be richer. Reputation awareness. Your reputation and the quality and attractiveness of your executive profile are really inextricably linked. Your reputation becomes either stronger or weaker with every phone conversation, every presentation, every interaction, every decision you make. And it's up to you to, if your reputation maybe it's been hit recently, or maybe you didn't have a presentation that didn't go as well as you wanted, it's up to you. It's your duty to do the damage control. And then the last type of awareness that I look for in executives is organizational awareness. And what that essentially means is having an understanding of how your role fits in the broader context of the company's business, their mission. It also encompasses your understanding of the work culture, how decisions are made, where the spheres of influence reside, and simply how to get things done. So, oftentimes awareness is, people think of it as just one word, but
right.
they're very different components of awareness, and it's necessary to be observant of all of these.
Right. I like it. I like that. We mostly think of awareness as self-awareness. All of these are, I guess, a subcategory of self-awareness, but I really like that you've made more clear, like, the idea of reputation, organization. So some of the things you talk about in your book also have to do with building your and strengthening your market position and profile. So, again, an aspect of influence in terms of how you can sell yourself to others. How does one do that in a way that's not too salesy, at the same time as humble, but at the same time has to be able to, you know, get themselves out there? I think that's a hard balance to do sometimes. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the career decisions that you make and putting yourself in a position where you are going to have influence. You know, I mean, influence, when I think about influence, I kind of think about, you know, the ability to have an impact on your surroundings, to be able to assert yourself, you know, collaborate, build teams, create followers. And when people think about developing their executive profile for influence, I think a lot of it, you need to take back a step or two and take a look at how are you positioned in the market. And the manner in which I like people to think about that is, you know, what is the supply and demand for talent like for what you do? And there really are four, you know, primary supply and demand talent scenarios. You know, there's the best quadrant to be in is, you know, high market demand with limited talent supply, right? If you are in that quadrant and your skills are so sought after, you're going to have influence, and it's going to be easier to have influence. You know, the other benefits of that quadrant is that, you know, the number of and quality of opportunities that come your way are going to be greater than others might see. You're going to have more compensation leverage, and you're probably going to advance more quickly in your career. So, you know, if you take that quadrant and compare it to, you know, what if you're in a low market demand, high talent supply quadrant, right? You've got a whole new set of challenges in terms of being able to garner influence, because there are a lot of people, you know, either within the same company or industry that are doing what you do, and your skill sets and your experience are not differentiated. So as someone goes through their career and they think of building their sphere of influence, I think they also need to be thinking about how can they differentiate themselves based on the skill sets and the experiences and the talents that they have.
So let's take an example of people in the Bay Area. I think, you know, we're in the Bay Area, and unless you're an engineer around here, you know, I think there's, you know, people are being sought after big time, and engineers are being pirated across, and, like, you know, it's just kind of a talent war for sure. I hate to use that word,
yeah.
But it really is.
It's high demand, limited supply.
Exactly. Probably more than anything else. So, but there's a lot of other kinds of jobs, like sales, product development, business development, those kinds of things that are, you know, in high demand too, but not maybe as much. Certainly information systems, the non-engineer type jobs. So what I'm wondering, what the question I have is, what are the specific things you would say to people who are, you know, in the second half of their career? So, you know, a lot of this, you know, again, the books out there are about millennials and about starting your careers. You're not only talking about executives, but you're talking about people who are in their late 40s, 50s, 60s that are, you know, maybe have left a job, maybe want to take time off, maybe have been laid off, whatever the reason. And they want to, like, you know, move on to something else. Are there anything specific you would say to them in let's say their 50s, 60s that you wouldn't say to maybe younger folks, or is it the same?
Well, what I have learned is that, you know, every individual situation is different. And you have 50 and 60 year olds who are just, because of their experience and talents, are, you know, much more favorably positioned. And you have others who maybe have not been attentive to mega trends and,
right.
and you know, technology and, mm-hmm. you know, advances that are taking place and, you know, how technology is gonna change the nature of their role or provide opportunities to do their role differently. I mean, the developments are occurring so quickly. If you're not thinking about that proactively, you can't help but find yourself behind the eight ball. But to more specifically answer your question, I encourage people who are in that type of situation that you described to really take a look at what is distinct about their background.
Right.
Everybody's going to have some, you know, some things that are distinct about their background. And most people are going to have, you know, one or two or three talents or skills or things that they do better than a large percentage of other people. And that is what I try to get people to focus on. And then to take a look at where else those skills might be applied. I think one of the healthiest things that somebody can do during their career is, instead of staying in a single industry and a single job function, just, you know, going straight up within a job function and within the same industry, where, you know, you become pretty narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage people to get some multifunctional experience in other not only other departments. Doesn't have to be your major, right? But it creates some additional perspective and flexibility. In a similar manner, I encourage people to think about other industries or other industry sectors that they could see themselves easily transitioning their skill sets to, because once you do that one time successfully, people take a look at that and said, gee, if he or she went from sector A to sector B, I have some confidence that they can go from B to C. And what this does for individuals is it, you know, geometrically expands the array of opportunities that they can be considered for in the future.
I'm wondering more about some specific things that you suggest to people that they do around this idea of distinction. So, what are some examples of in building somebody's profile, how they can like, what have you seen in terms of how they can look distinct? I mean, I know that. That's a general question, but I mean, maybe give us some real-life examples.
Sure. Let me think about this for a minute.
More.
Okay. You know, back, this is an example of an individual I know, have known throughout the years, and he has become extremely successful, becoming head of marketing for a very large global social platform. But he started his career in consumer packaged goods. Okay.
Right. Interesting.
And so he had some classic marketing training. He had a little bit of McKinsey. And
right.
Then when the internet started to really poke its head up, you know, in 94, he said, you know what, I'm going to develop an online home services company over the next several years. So he dove into that.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't afraid, right? He knew it was a risk, but it became a real growth experience for him. And it was that experience that was attractive to companies on the West Coast. So, you know, he since then he's been with two or three major West Coast technology companies, building up different experiences, and you know, his job satisfaction, his advancement, his earnings have come a long way.
You know, I think one of the things that would be interesting for people on the call, and I'm also interested in, as far as what I could be telling my clients, is how do they best work with a search firm? I think it would be interesting for us to hear about the search process, and then again, an example of how someone can work with a search firm, work with recruiters,
yes,
that kind of thing.
Well, I'm going to address this from the perspective that I have, which is that of a senior level global executive search firm.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Search has changed demonstrably, you know, over the past, you know, 10 to 12 years. The basic steps in the search process for professional firms, I don't think have changed that much. And I'll describe briefly what they are, and then I can describe how the industry has changed.
Okay.
Every search starts out with what we call an environmental study, where the consultant is on site with the client and the key hiring executives, and you know, develops a thorough understanding of the role, the requirements, what the objectives are, what the business strategy is, what the supporting team looks like, the budget, et cetera, et cetera. With that understanding, a very detailed position specification is drafted, and that's used not only to so that you have common marching orders from the client, right? A level of understanding, common understanding, but also to educate the prospective candidates. It also serves, if it's well done, as an attraction vehicle. And typical search, once the spec is done, on a typical search, we will reach out to probably, you know, let's say 150, 180 executives, and these will be both prospective candidates as well as networking sources. And out of that, we may get, on average, 20 to 25 people who declare varying levels of interest. We review those backgrounds internally. We decide what our long list is going to look like that we share with the client. That typically consists of about, I'd say, on average, 15 executives, 12 to 15 executives. In reviewing that with the client, those executives are force-ranked by their attractiveness, and we will go out. We will interview face-to-face, I'd say, 8 to 10 of those executives, and present, on average, 6 to the client. So that's a little bit about how the numbers break down. Obviously, every search is different. Some are entirely confidential. Others are quite public. Where the industry's changed, and this
yeah.
is for your audience, I think an important point to make is that over the years, with the increasing expansion of the search firms' databases, the role of the research associate who teams with the consultant has become increasingly involved and evident. So not only do they mine the database for sources, networking sources, and prospects, but they are also today very active in the initial sourcing and prospecting calls. Consultants used to make, 80% of those overtures. Today on average, I'd say consultants make, while it can vary across firm, I'd say in the larger firms, the consultants make 15 to 20% of the overtures. Because the consultants don't have as much time as the research associates. You have to remember the consultants are responsible for managing clients, doing all the face-to-face interviewing of the candidates, developing new business, managing client expectations. The research associates are not really involved with that, so they have more time to be sending out email overtures and on the phone doing the sourcing and the prospecting. So as an executive, when you're reaching out to the search firms, I think it's important for you to also be reaching out to the appropriate research associates who are teaming with consultants, with consultants who are active in your specialty.
So how are you finding, and how are people finding this, the idea of how is LinkedIn helping, hindering, and then also how is it, from the perspective of the search firm, I know getting a hold of people and getting them to even be open to looking at jobs when they already are in a job is difficult. So tell us a little bit about that, and then I'm going to also ask you some questions from the executive's perspective too.
Okay. Let's see, I think the first part of your question was about
LinkedIn, and then the second part LinkedIn. More about how you're able to get a hold of executives.
Sure. Well, LinkedIn to date, and I'm not saying this is LinkedIn in the future, but LinkedIn to date, I think, is a valuable tool at the VP level on down. Okay, and that's for two reasons. There are a number of senior executives who just don't spend a lot of time developing their profiles on LinkedIn, okay? And the more senior the search, the richer the search firm's database with lots and lots of information on a prospect or a candidate that goes well beyond what's available on LinkedIn. Who's to say that may not change in the future? As millennials, move up the ranks, I think that has yet to play out.
And then from the perspective of the executives, what would be the process for them if they're thinking about making a move, but, want to be private about it? They're not going to announce it, obviously. Let's say the higher ranks, it can't be public. So what is the best process for them, just assuming they're already in a job, right, and they're considering moving? What's the best process for them? You mentioned the idea of getting a hold of associates and research people but within a search firm, but, what would be a process for them to get a hold of the appropriate people and start a process? Or start a relationship.
Right. Well, there are some online directories out there that will list search firms, and they go so far as to identify consultants and the practices that the consultants are involved with. I think it's very appropriate that executives approach a search firm that is consistent with their level of experience and responsibilities in the years that they've been in industry. There are mid-level firms, there are senior firms, and then there's entry level. With the senior firms, most all of the major senior firms will have a website that goes deeply into each of their practice areas and identifies specifically who the consultants are and provides contact information as well as background on the search consultant. The first step in getting a hold of of these individuals recognizing that they're busy is to send out a brief, you know, cover email with a well-done resume attached, saying, listen, you know, I'm currently well-employed. I'm not presently thinking of making a move, but if something extraordinary came up, I'd be very interested in hearing from you. And within that cover email, the executive should bullet point their relocation parameters, what their ideal role would look like, and whether they have any non-competes. This will make it a lot easier for the search firm to determine which types of searches they should be approaching the executive about. And very often the search firms in the past, I don't think they're able to do it legally now, but in the past they would also want to understand your compensation package.
Salary, yeah, yeah.
Salary, so that, you know, they're not calling about an opportunity that's beneath what you're making or so far above it that you're making that you wouldn't be a legitimate candidate.
So since you're in the, you know, you were in the service of matchmaking, essentially, doesn't it make sense to do this way, I mean, even way before you're interested in making a move?
From both perspectives.
I mean, it's just sort of like, you know, it's the same idea of when you want something, you don't wait till you want something to ask to try to build a relationship with people. I mean, you want to have building a relationship all along. So even if somebody is, as I said, well employed, they're happy where they are, and maybe they'll make the move in 3 years.
Well, I should have added that within that cover email, you should ask, make it, let it be known that your inquiry is confidential.
Yep.
And also ask that should there be other colleagues within the firm who might have interest in your background, that you'd appreciate your information being passed along. And you should also, if you you can probably identify who the appropriate research associates are, and or ask in the cover email that the appropriate research associates be noted. A firm like Spencer Stewart, we operated with confidentiality every day. We just assumed everything was confidential unless executives informed us otherwise.
Yeah, it seems to me the consultants would be wanting to reach out to, let's say you're doing, you know, I know Spencer Stewart does a lot of CEO and C-suite searches, so it seems to me reaching out to people knowing that they're well-employed for 3 years from now. You know, so I would think you'd be doing that reach out as well, right?
Oh, we are always, this is a people business.
Sure.
We are always looking to build our networks. You know, one way that the firm does that, and sometimes I still speak as if I'm still there, but one way that the, you know, firm does that with the brand name that they have, they have a tremendous power to convene. And by that I mean to bring together senior executives for, you know, we have a board governance event every year. We have had an annual chief marketing officer summit in New York for the past 15 years. We get broad participation in that, and it's a way for us to get to know others. But also individually, you know, every consultant has a list of people they're trying to get to know better. Not only as prospective, it's funny how often a prospective candidate ends up becoming a client.
Right, exactly. Interesting. So, Chris, this has been lovely. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you could, any other words of wisdom, any other insights you'd like to give the group?
I thought one of the questions that would be appropriate to talk about a little is how do you go about strengthening your influencing skills? And this is something where I've had to coach others. There are a number of things, and I'm just going to tick them off quickly.
Sure.
I think you have to understand when to speak and when to listen would be one. And I can go into that more deeply, but I just want to get through these. Building personal and political capital by proactively getting to know others in the organization one-on-one, both within your department and outside your department. I think you can gain influence by becoming involved or forming a task force, a multifunctional task force group within your company to tackle a particular business problem or opportunity. Not only will you learn from this experience, but you'll have the opportunity to show yourself. I think a lot of people, this is a separate point, fall into the trap of, if I work hard enough and long enough, others will notice me in my work. And that is just not true. It may happen, but you're not going to get all the credit that you deserve. So you don't want to be doing your work in a vacuum. You don't want to be accomplishing your objectives in a vacuum. You want to be visible. You want to team with others. You want to inform others of your progress on key initiatives and programs and let them be part of the solution. Another point, and I've alluded to this previously, develop and maintain a broad perspective of how what you do fits into the remainder of the organization and how others think. Again, if you're operating in a vacuum, it's going to be more difficult to understand how to accomplish your objectives and be successful. People who have influence give credit to others, and they do it generously. When you do that, they're much more willing to be supportive of you in the future. And building teams, engaging teams, is very much a part of having influence. Offering unsolicited support, exhibiting a great attitude, taking time to explain what you're doing. I think that's all part of building influence. And also, and I've seen a number of executives go wrong here, you don't have to let people know you're the smartest person in the room. Mm-hmm. Take the time to listen to other points of view. So those were some thoughts on building your influencing skills.
Nice. Thank you. Everybody's unmuted now. Does anybody have any comments or questions about their experience in searches and their experience in their careers moving from director to executive, for example, or anything else they want to bring up?
Sue, this is Kathy Hart with Clear Vision Consulting. Yeah, so my question, and this was brought up, and I really appreciate the point where there was a discussion about people both getting multifunctional experience as well as multi-industry experience. And I would just be willing to hear very briefly, if you have somebody that is literally trying to go from one industry to another, they don't have a lot of experience and they're trying to figure out, how do they shift their LinkedIn, their resume, what are things that they can do that makes them more attractive to that other industry when they don't have experience there?
Yeah. That's a great question. In your current position, okay, while you're in it, you need to be thinking about how can you gain different experiences, okay, to show that you have the ability to come into a new situation, learn, adapt, and then influence, okay? That learn, adapt, influence behavior is critical to being able to make successful industry transitions. There are people who I have seen who tend to more easily transition across industries, and some of these are individuals who've had that cross-functional experience within their own company. General management consultants who have had to go into different corporate environments and work on different business issues and come up to speed and then learn how to relate effectively to the management team. They tend to have some basic skills in terms of transitioning successfully. If somebody has not transitioned into a new industry but is looking to do so, I would encourage them to initially start with a transition that is closer into their current industry. Because a larger percentage of what they know and what they do will be applicable. I wouldn't do a stretch move into an industry that is totally different until you have several successful industry transitions under your belt and understand how to do so.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
Actually, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
You're welcome.
Yeah, this is Rose Baldwin, and
hi,
I'm
Rose.
I'm with Torchiana, and we're career consultants. So
right.
one question I have is, we're hearing a lot about the gig economy and how the future of work is going to be shifting considerably. I'm just curious if you have anything to say about that in the context of what we've been discussing.
Yeah, you mean contract employees or more rapid career movement, job
yes,
movement?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And also the influence and the rapid technology influence on careers as well. So all of that is part of the gig economy.
For people who have very, very unique sets of skills and love the autonomy and the freedom and who stay at the top of their craft, okay, that is a viable alternative, okay? But individuals who cannot stay at the top of their craft or up to date with the technology and continue to add value, okay, are going to find that to be a very tough row to hoe. One of the things that clients look at, and again, this is at the senior executive level, is the stability of an individual. They don't want to bring in and acclimate a senior executive who's only going to be with them for a year or 18 months. They want to know that their investment in that individual is going to pay off minimally over the next 3 or 4 years. I counsel people when they are thinking of moving to a different company to first explore what other opportunities are there for you within your current company that would provide you additional skill sets and a learning opportunity. Does that answer everything you were asking, or were there some components I didn't hit on?
Yeah, no, I think that was a good overview. I think the unique skills and staying at the top of their craft and up to date on technology is informative in terms of people who want to take advantage of that and see that as a possible career strategy for them in the future. Thank
yep.
you.
You know, the risk with something like that is that technology changes what they do and all of a sudden they become irrelevant. And that's, you don't want irrelevance.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Rose, and thanks, Chris, very much. We're really at time now. And again, I wanted to highlight Chris's book, The Proactive Executive, his Twitter account. You can write him there, at Nadherny Chris, and his website, chrisnadherny.com. I also wanted to highlight our next Wise Talk. It will be in March. Right now we have it scheduled March 21st at 11 a.m. That may change to the 22nd and 23rd. So keep abreast of that through Allison. She'll be sending things out. We'll be talking with Jennifer Conwheeler. She's the author of The Introverted Leader, Building on Your Quiet Strengths. So we're going to continue our quest here to talk about influencing and trying to get as many different perspectives as possible. So have a wonderful rest of the day, and Chris, thanks again for your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sue.
Okay. See you later now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.